Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
Welcome to our first 2022 edition of the VanCast. Farhan Lalji and Thomas Drance with you, ringing in the new year. And this podcast is brought to you by DirecTV Stream. Get your TV together with the best of live and on demand. Learn more at directtv.com. Drancer, last time we talked, it was before the Brock Besser announcement. It was before the first of these three games to close the 2021 calendar year. The Canucks go 2-0-1 during that stretch without Brock Besser, without Jason Dickinson for this last game against Seattle. And here we are, ready to ring in the new year with a bit of an extended break, a game coming up against Ottawa, and a team that's 2 points out of the playoffs.
Yeah, I know. Well, 2 points out of the playoffs, yes. They are 2 points out of the playoffs, but we all know how the NHL standings were.
Oh, I know. Right? I know.
The framing of that, right, is why I keep going back to the Dom model, right? Because it's like, it's so easy to say 2 points out of the playoffs, but the standings are designed to trick you. They're designed to make you think you're close. But if you're 2 points out and Edmonton has two games in hand, and you also have to outperform Winnipeg and Los Angeles, like, by a pretty significant margin, not to mention also probably Dallas, who has a higher point percentage. You know, it's not quite so easy as just being 2 points better than one team over the balance. It's being 2 points better than a lot of them who also have games in hand on you. But, man, that takes nothing away from, like, I think about that first period in Seattle and just think that's a gear that this team just didn't have. Like, that's a gear that this team just could not reach in the early part of the season.
Yeah, there's no question. And, you know, we used to joke back in the day about Travis Green that every time he had a meeting with a player, that player all of a sudden turned their game around. Well, you know, all of a sudden Bruce Boudreaux asks for some secondary scoring and bam, he gets it just like that against Seattle with Podkolzin, with Hoglander, with Mott. Like, wow, where did that come from?
Yeah, it was pretty great. And look, Seattle, I mean, what a mess. What a mess that team is, right? I thought when it was 2-0, I thought to myself, I didn't say it and I didn't tweet it, but I thought to myself, I was like, there's no way they're scoring on Demko tonight. And as I thought it, they scored that, like, dinky one off the top, right? Because that's just how hockey works. But, I mean, they just looked so punchless relative to Vancouver. And, you know, Vancouver surrendered one high-danger chance at 5-on-5 the entire game per natural stat trick. So, you know, I think about that, and I think about that third period against Anaheim. The third period against Anaheim. And, like, those are just the Canucks throttling teams that honestly didn't look like they were in Vancouver's weight class, which, considering that Anaheim's one of the teams that, you know, they'd hope to reel in, you know, augur as well, I think, right? Like, that's a good sign. You need to be able to look like that against a team like Anaheim. And certainly against a bottom feeder like the Seattle Kraken, who've bungled their expansion season in extraordinary fashion. So, all positive vibes from this Canucks team. And I think we should get into it. Like, I think we should get into a little bit of what are reasonable expectations? How different do you think this team is? How much has your view of them changed as a result of this 8-0-1 stretch, undefeated in regulation in the Boudreaux era to this point?
Yeah, it's completely changed my expectations. And I say that for a couple of reasons. One, they've already had the momentum sucking break. over Christmas that was supposed to determine what they really were, because now it's more than just a bump. So now we're seeing 2-0-1. Then we saw them do it without Brock Besser, because he was on a, you know, he was getting on a bit of a roll before that extended Christmas break, right? And Boudreaux had reached him and he was being more aggressive with the shot. So now we know we're going to have a team that's going to be dealing with injuries later on, or more COVID or whatever it happens to be. But a team that had no ability to deal with adversity previously has now shown the ability to deal with some adversity, right? And now they've got both goaltenders doing some things. So if all of a sudden something happens with Demko, you could feel comfortable that you can tread water with Halak. And even when you've got to put him in every time on a back-to-back, which the schedule at some point will compress because they've got to make up these six games, you're going to have to lean on him a little bit. And now you've got him going. And you've got some defensemen, which were complete liabilities in, you know, for Myers. Whenever you elevate him, you know, he can give you a little bit for a short amount of time, but then all of a sudden the flaws get exposed. He's starting to show some things. Tucker Poolman is starting to show some things. So it's not just the run, but it's the run with some of the issues they've had to encounter, which normally would have completely derailed a team, which the GM rightly labeled as fragile. Mm-hmm. So yes, they've still got flaws, you know, on the back end, but they're, right now, they're masking them based on what they're doing up the ice. That's exposing them a little bit less, you know, so strategically it's helping. So when I look at every piece of it, they seem to have a short-term answer. And that's not to say they're going to go on this particular point percentage
for the rest of the season.
That's not possible.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I think you can recalibrate your expectations and say, okay, this team should be able to punch for the next 6 weeks, the next 8 weeks, and then we can have the discussion again heading into the trade deadline.
Yeah, I mean, they do have the hardest schedule from here on out, right? In terms of difficulty of schedule, the Canucks number one in the league from this point forward. And they don't play a lot here. That could be an advantage to them, right? We've seen them sort of benefit, I think, from a layoff. Like
But they'll also get some home games back.
They also get some home games back, for sure. So, you know, we'll sort of see exactly what this all looks like. And look, if you have home ice, if you have home games like on Vancouver ice with this team exciting this market in this way, that's a totally different deal too, right? Like, that's a real home ice advantage that they're probably going to be looking at, especially as people get back out in public following, you know, whatever this is. So the thing is, I'm sort of two minds of this, because I went a bit under the hood last night just in preparation for, you know, this week. Like, I've been kind of off, right? Like, I've been in Irish coffee or Irish cream in my coffee every morning since like December 22nd until this morning. Now I'm drinking it with skim milk the way I usually do. And so I went under the hood just to prepare myself, just to like get ready for this week. And, you know, at 5-on-5 anyway, right? At 5-on-5, at even strength, this club is doing a little bit worse, actually, by shot attempt differential, by Corsi 4, right? Under Boudreaux than they were under Green, about 3%. And it doesn't match the results, right? And it's not really a massive dip one way or the other, especially considering the samples are so much bigger in the case of the club's performance through December 4th than they have been since. Even some of the higher event numbers that we've talked about, right? That the club is sort of going on this tear in terms of generating more, but also surrendering more. Like, that's kind of muted itself a little bit too, but the club is still generating something like 33% more expected goals per hour, 5-on-5, at the expense of only about 25% more expected goals against per hour. And that's a really good trade-off, right? That puts the Canucks in a better spot overall, but it's statistically not a huge difference in terms of the overall ratio, right? Like, we're looking at something like 2.5% of an expected goals bump from the Boudreaux effect versus what they were doing against Travis Green. So it's like slightly higher event, but the ratio's not much changed in terms of their 5-on-5 form. And honestly, the biggest difference in the club's 5-on-5 profile, Farhan, for me, and not just for me, but in terms of a sort of objective look at it, is that under Green, the Canucks were at 99.6 PDO, right? Great goaltending, 93% goaltending, 6-ish percent shooting percentage. And under Boudreaux, they're at 117, 95% goaltending and 7% shooting, right? So to me, at 5-on-5 anyway, the Boudreaux bump, you know, for the most part, I mean, it's real. There is a definite change in flow, but the biggest difference really isn't that. It's that the Canucks are on fire in terms of capitalizing on their opportunities and preventing goals at 5-on-5. And honestly, the same goes for the power play. Like, it's performed better under Boudreaux, right? But the underlying profile's essentially the same, Farhan. Like, Vancouver's power play for me was always going to figure it out. How many times did I say it, right? I wasn't too worried about it. And that's come to pass. Like, the club was generating attempts at the fifth best rate under Green. They're generating attempts at the seventh best rate under Boudreaux. The club was taking 61.9 shots per hour under Green on the 5-on-4. They're now taking 62.5 shots, right? Like, the difference is, you know, in the hundreds or the tenths. That similarity holds across the board when we look at the Canucks power play. So why does it look so different, right? The answer is that under Boudreaux, the Canucks are converting on 22% of power play shots. Under Green, that number was at 10%. And finally, we get to the penalty kill, right? And this is the area where Vancouver's fortunes have reversed themselves most dramatically, frankly, right? Like, it's also the phase of the game in which we have the most movement in terms of, like, a meaningfully different underlying profile. And the big juicy headline here is that the Canucks have cut 20 shots per hour from what they're surrendering under Boudreaux versus what they were surrendering under Green with Bomber running the PK. And obviously it's now Scott Walker running the PK. It's massive, but it's also interesting that the drop in shots against, which is massive, right, isn't really reflected elsewhere. Like, the club has only cut 4 shot attempts per hour under Walker versus 20 shots against. They're actually surrendering scoring chances at a higher rate running Walker's PK than they were running Baumgartner's. And the expected goal difference is relatively slim too. Like, it's 1 expected goal per hour. Overall, that's not nothing. Like, the PK is clearly accomplishing more and surrendering less, permitting less. And that 20 shots per hour is something so dramatic that I'd weight it really heavily in saying with a good degree of confidence, like, the club is improved on the penalty kill. But again, Farhan, the most dramatic difference we observe isn't really about form so much as it's about outcome. Under Bomber, the Canucks PK played in front of 790 save percentage goaltending. Under Walker to this point, it's 92.3, right? I mean, that's a huge gap, like, a massive gap. And so when I put it all together, I just don't see a sustainable bump in which the Canucks have morphed overnight into some team that's better than the club that I expected them to be going into this season. Certainly they're looking better than they played in October and November, but I don't know that I see more than the profile of a team that I'd say is a fringe playoff club on a heater. And so, you know, I see better vibes. I see more confidence. I certainly see a team that's throwing a fastball, unlike what they could manage in October and November. But overall, I kind of still see a middling 5-on-5 team with a PK that's still going to be an issue at some point this season with their current personnel, and a quality power play that's on a percentage-driven bender. And honestly, I'd bet heavily against those bounces continuing to go in the Canucks' favor indefinitely, like, particularly when the competition ramps up this month. And I don't mean to be the Debbie Downer guy, but this is, you know, I have a very set way of looking at the game and trying to parse out what's real, what's fortunate, where's the puck luck here. And, you know, in every respect, I mean, there are good things happening. There are more expected. The team is playing higher event 5-on-5. They're permitting far less on the power play. But again, it's really about a reversal in fortunes here and not a reversal in form. This is not like when Sutter took over for Ward and the Flames just started controlling play at an elite rate and looking like an elite 5-on-5 team, even though the results took a while to catch up to that. This is something a little bit different. And something that, you know, for me doesn't actually fundamentally alter how I view this team's, like, big picture trajectory in terms of what they need to do to get to like back to contending for a cup.
The power play save percentage numbers that you talked about, 79% under Green, 92.3 under Boudreau. I tend to think that that's more, the percentage that we're seeing under Boudreau is more of what Thatcher Demko really is versus the 79% we saw under Green. I mean,
no one does 923 forever on the PK.
Understood. But 79 is something nobody does forever on the PK either.
No, correct. That's true.
Right. So, like, you know, to me, I look at it as somewhere closer to the mid to high 80s for Demko, which still allows them to operate at a more functional rate than what they were doing previously.
Yeah, totally. Well, and look, on the PK, save percentage is a lot more or a lot less about individual ability and a lot more about like what crossing passes you're surrendering. Right. So, you know, I think the reflection you're seeing in save percentage too. Does like it's easy for me to hand wave it and be like, that's a huge gap, it's unsustainable, blah blah blah. But like, it does reflect the fact too that I do think the club's getting throttled, you know, in terms of those like multiple cross-seam passes resulting in a tap in. I do think we're seeing that a lot less, and I think that's a big part of what we're seeing too. But we're also seeing Thatcher Demko just, you know, he third star of the month in December, a tremendous recognition from the league and well deserved. You know, we are also seeing Thatcher Demko just sort of set up a force field in the net. And, you know, he can have these dominant stretches. He may even be able to sustain it. But at some point, you know, what he's doing is at a level, like what he's doing under Boudreau is at a level that I don't think anyone can expect to last forever.
No, for sure. But at the same time, right now, the guy's putting up literally Vezina Trophy numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, this month, he's right there. What has to happen for him to be seriously in the discussion from a team's win-loss standpoint?
Well, I think if the Canucks even get back into the playoff race, he'll be widely talked about as a contender. I really do. I mean, the narrative heft of that, I think, matters a lot. Remember, though, that it is GMs who vote on the Vezina, not the media. So, yep. You know, probably pretty hard to offset some of the like absolute stud starting goalies whose teams have sort of paced from the get-go, as it were. But you know, I think the narrative heft of if this team gets back into it and Thatcher Demko is a 935, 940 goaltender who wins a ton of games, you know, I do think that you're going to see him get serious consideration along with, you know, maybe a Freddie Anderson. Like Freddie Anderson would have to be in that discussion, I think. Jacob Markstrom, Vasilevsky always, especially if that team, you know, hangs tough and is sort of second or third in that division. I think Jack Campbell is probably going to have some discussion too. So, you know, that's sort of my short list at this point. Maybe Tristan Jarry would be sort of my short list of the goalies who've been absolutely ridiculous all year. That would kind of be those would be the guys that I'd expect to be seriously considered.
Want to ask you a bit about the reaction that this team has faced or has given. You listen to Boudreau when he talked about the Kings game and, you know, the worst period since he's been here and, you know, and then later on the best period since he's been here when they got to Seattle. Like there's been those moments of emotional accountability where I'm not saying he's calling people out, but he's not sugarcoating what we're looking at.
Yeah.
How do you think the group's responding?
Well, pretty well, right? I mean, that Kings game was a schedule loss, a really tough to play back to back like that after a layoff, right? I mean, that's a brutal way to be reintroduced, but they were throttled in that game, right? Like,
first two periods. Yeah, third period they were better, but yeah, first two periods were awful.
Yeah, I mean, on the whole though, they were throttled, and
no question.
But they bounced back. They bounced back and put in their best start under Boudreau in Seattle, and so you love to see it. Like you love to see all of that, especially since the team traveled that day, which you don't often see in the regular season in the NHL. Right? You usually see teams settled, but COVID sort of changing things up, making things that aren't common. And so, you know, I mean, I think that's a tremendous response. The fact that the fact that the depth players were called to the carpet and immediately the club got all this supporting offense. That's great. That's what you need. Like that's, you can't really draw it up like that, but if you could, you can't draw it up better. So look, I think it's pretty clear that this team's found something to believe in Bruce Boudreau, right? And we'll see how long that lasts. Like we'll see how, if he can keep pressing the right buttons here. His record indicates that he's a decent bet to be able to. And that's a very, very positive thing for this hockey club.
Yeah, it is. You know, and what I bring up the question about kind of how they've reacted to that, to those pieces, because I see a team that's just a lot less, you know, I used the word fragile earlier when Benning referred to them as that, and they were, right? And you talk about the power play, sorry, the penalty kill, and this team was defeated on the penalty kill the second the penalty was called, right? I mean, that happened.
Totally.
And now it's a little different. First, they're not taking as many penalties, but on top of that, when some of those moments happen, they're just simply not as rattled as they were previously. It's been a while since I've seen a team have this level of emotional turn.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think... The thing is, though, Farhan, is I think to really judge that, we need to see them get punched in the mouth.
Meaning what? Like a 3-0, trailing 3-0 in a game? Or what are we thinking?
They're going to bump into an elite team that lost the night before that comes at them, you know, in a different way. They're going to stop bumping into backups every game, right? Like they're going to, if this team's going to get to where they need to get to, they're going to encounter circumstances that are more challenging, and you know, it's one thing to run downhill, right? It's another to run uphill, and we've seen the Canucks beat run downhill for the most part in the Boudreau era, with percentages going their way, bounces going their way, tons of teams coming into Vancouver on the second leg of back-to-back, a run of backup goalies. Like, we need to see what this team can do when they get punched in the mouth, when things don't go their way. I think to before we conclude that there's this new level of fortitude that they've found under Boudreau.
Yeah, it's fair. You know, and right now it seems that enough in their game goes right on a given night. So against LA, your first two periods, you're horrible, but your goaltender bails you out. Your backup goaltender bails you out and keeps you in the game. And it just seems like they're currently able to lean enough on one piece of their game just to kind of allow them to tread some water. And they haven't been punched in the mouth in terms of losing a couple of games yet, where they've still got to bounce back from that. But just in game, it seems that when they've had, you know, bits of adversity, they've still managed to come through that. And you're right. I mean, it's not a big punch. It's not a big punch. It's a rabid punch.
Yeah, but it's also one thing to overcome adversity when you're getting 95% goaltending.
No
right?
Question.
Like, yeah. Like the test in the NHL, right? I've often said that there's about 10 games you win no matter what you do, and there's 10 games you lose no matter what you do, right? And then there's sort of the rest. There's what you do with the rest. And, you know, the mark of a good team for me over a course of an 82-game season is when everything falls apart, right? You can't get a single bounce. You have to work four times as hard as your opposition to get a goal, right? And we all see these games in hockey every year, year after year, right? Those games where it's like teams swarming, you know, they control, they have like four heavy shifts in a row, unscreened rush, wrist shot chance the other way, goal, right? And it's like, you do it again, same result. You're down 2-0. You've played great. You know, like we all see those games year after year. That's the nature of a variable sport like hockey. And the difference between really good teams and really bad teams is that really good teams have a higher baseline. When the things go against them, right? Every team will win 5 or 6 in a row. Every team will have a good stretch, right? A stretch where they win 5 and 6, where they win 8 and 9, right? Like the historically bad Ted Nolan Buffalo Sabres won 10 games in a row, right? Like every team will have those stretches when things are going your way, because that's what happens in hockey. Like random distribution basically guarantees that if you play enough hockey, if you play 82 games, you're going to have runs in which you're fortunate or the opposite, where everything's going against you in terms of puck luck. And the difference between a really good team and a really bad team is when everything goes against a really good team, they'll still find a way to win 5 of those 10 games, right? And 2 of the other ones they'll lose after regulation. So they come out with, you know, a 55% point percentage. And then when things go their way, they'll go like, you know, 8-0-1, like the Canucks have the last 9 games. Like, the good thing about this is that with things going their way, the Canucks have managed to take advantage. And that's actually different because in October, things were going the Canucks' way in a similar realm at 5-on-5 anyway, in terms of the way Thatcher Demko was playing, in terms of some of the positive percentages. It's just that they were still losing. They weren't taking advantage of it because the penalty kill was such a disaster and the power play couldn't score. And so, you know, the improvement for me now is like, hey, the Canucks with wind at their back are at least able to take advantage over the course of the past month. But when things go against them, what does this look like? And we don't know yet. And we don't know yet because we haven't seen it. Things have been at their back. Their power play shooting percentage is through the roof. Their penalty kill save percentage is through the roof. At 5-on-5, their shooting percentage is elevated and their save percentage is elevated. Like, what I need to see is what this Canucks team looks like when the bounces dry up, because that will happen with 50 plus games remaining on their schedule.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
All right, Trancher. Let's look at this team's schedule now, and they've got the week off. You'd think that by the end of it, by the time Ottawa comes to town, that first of all, why is the midweek game canceled and the Ottawa game still happening? Can you explain that one to me? Given it's 50, we were told it's because of attendance, but yet it's the same 50% for both games.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Ottawa one is interesting to me, and you know. Like, well, let's talk about the schedule. Like, okay, but for now, right? It feels like everything's kind of day to day, hour to hour still, right? I mean, the NHL has now charted its course, right? They're going to maximize revenue to the greatest extent possible. They're going to do what they can to play the games where the buildings are full. They're going to try and press forward and through this COVID outbreak, which is obviously what the players want to do, and obviously what makes the most business sense for the league. And so, you know, all of that said, like, the NHL might have figured out their preferred route through, and it might relatively closely match what Adam Silver has sort of described the NBA wanting to do, live with the virus, and what the NFL has certainly decided to do. In a similar vein with Carson Wentz playing against playing on Sunday. The fact is that those leagues don't contend with the Canadian government the same way. Right. And so that remains a work in progress, and we'll just sort of see. Like, the Canucks are, like the other 7 Canadian teams, the team that's most affected by this, right? That's going to be most affected by this.
But was Wednesday a government decision? Because we're led to believe by the NHL that it wasn't, that it was purely a business decision, and the same business case is going to be made on Saturday.
Well, I think the other part of it was, like, the other part of the decision was made because they're sort of in a holding pattern in terms of bringing American teams into Canada, right? Because of what Canada's COVID regulations require in terms of teams coming back. I mean, you look at Brock Besser, who tests positive in California and is now in limbo. Jason Dickinson, too, tests positive in Seattle. They're both in limbo in terms of when they can come back. So if you're living in a world with a five-day protocol for NHL players testing out of the protocol, right? But then they have to come to Canada 8 days after, 3 days after they've tested out of the protocol, but Canada doesn't let you in for another 6 days.
Yeah, which is crazy here because it's now a five-day regulation here when you're in the country.
Yeah, no, I know, but not for re-entering the country.
It's ridiculous.
So I'm just saying that's why for me, it's not about like, it's not necessarily a hard government decision not to play the Islanders, but to play the Senators. It's that the league is still navigating how to operate in this world, in this new, you know, sort of, and everything that Omicron has brought us, with a border. Right. So we're seeing Canadian teams play Canadian teams. We're seeing American teams play American teams. We're seeing Canadian teams go down to the States. You know, what we haven't seen in a while is a Canadian team come up here. And my guess is that's something the league, you know, is very happy to take some time off from. Right. I mean, games have been canceled through what, the 12th of January for American teams up here. The Islanders had their whole road trip scrapped. So, you know, it's more complicated than a government versus business decision. It's a navigating the border decision, which is a huge factor here too.
But navigating the border is a government decision. And when you look at what the protocols are for people in the country versus residents of the country coming back, it's ridiculous. And you hope the government can figure it out, because that part of it, and this is not me dismissive of the of Omicron, that part of it is purely optics. Yeah. Well, that somebody in the country who has it can be tested, can be treated one way, and someone coming into the country who has it has to be treated a completely different way. That is complete optics.
Well, I mean, I don't think you're wrong, but I think the bet from a league standpoint is that, you know, if you give the Canadian government and the provincial authorities some time, they'll be able to make a determination with some confidence, like, you know, in terms of what
they'll be able to find a way to justify it and craftily create the message.
Well, or that the Canadian reintroduction of restrictions in the face of this Omicron wave, right, which stands in contrast with the American decision not to, right? That Canada will ultimately come closer to what the U.S. has decided. You know, basically the decision, the bet is that this Omicron wave is like bad short-term news, but not a long-term threat to the ability to play this season in front of fans. That's the bet being made, right? And that makes sense with what we've seen in South Africa and England, which is a shorter wave than the ones we saw with Delta and Alpha and on and on. So that, to me, is like the fundamental bet that the league is making here, that this is, you know, a tough short-term hit that we have to navigate, but long-term isn't a threat to the schedule. And maybe that's optimistic, maybe that's hopeful, but I don't think it's without merit. I don't think it's without any basis in reality based on the experience that we've, you know, observed in countries that are a little bit ahead of Vancouver or ahead of Canada in terms of dealing with this new variant than we are.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Meanwhile, the Canucks will play on Saturday. So their schedule for this week is they'll practice Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. After having taken Sunday off, they'll take Thursday off, practice Friday, play Saturday. And then you'll probably see a team that's pretty excited to get on the road so they don't have to deal with all of this stuff. But they'll dive right into the hotbed of it in Florida with back-to-back games next week on Tuesday and Thursday. Carolina, Washington, and Nashville. So that's a daunting five-day road trip.
That is a murderer's row, right? It's like,
well, you better win on Saturday.
You get a week plus to prepare for Ottawa. JT Miller just licking his lips like, oh, buddy, let's go. And then you get thrown in against a bunch of, you know, absolute meat grinder teams in the southern half of the United States. I mean, that's as tough as it gets. Like the Caps and the Canes are two of the best teams in the NHL by point percentage. We all know what Tampa Bay is, right? They're the back-to-back champs. Florida's, you know, if you're not on your game, Florida's putting up 7 on you, right? Like, they put up 9 the other day. They are against Tampa. They put up 9 on Tampa. Like, that team has, you know, 2 first lines and 2 third lines, right? Like, they are so explosive. And then Nashville, who's got UC Saros, who I neglected to mention Saros as a potential Vezina contender, but he probably deserves mention there too. And that team's, I mean, playoff bound. Like, that's one of the teams Vancouver might realistically hope to reel in, actually. But maybe not, because they're playing pretty well and they've got a goalie at the absolute top of his form. So, that's as tough a trip as it gets. And we're going to learn a lot about this team. And you know, I want to talk about this a little bit because I think this is the most fascinating part. We've been so focused on the Boudreau bump, right? That the logic of Jim Rutherford, right? Of a new GM, untied to any player on this roster, untied to any player in this lineup, and what he's thinking, how he's observing this win streak. Does it change his plans, right? Like, that dynamic as he looks to make his stamp on this roster, I think is a really fascinating one, because, you know, and it's sort of why that question that I asked you to start the podcast, like, has your view of this team materially changed? And you sort of indicated it has, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
But there's a gentleman with a 3-year contract who's won 3 Stanley Cups, but Stanley Cups in 2 different markets. He's looking to become one of the first people ever. The first person ever to win a Stanley Cup in 3 different markets, right? There's a person who's going to at some point make decisions based on what he's seen and what he's experienced and what he thinks that this team needs. What's he thinking? Like, that is the biggest question facing this team. And to hear him talk, you know, on Sportsnet 650, in various articles, you know, I think he's a lot. I mean, I pretty clearly from the tone of his commentary, like, I think he's, you know, and I don't want to say less impressed, but I don't know that his view of this team has changed from his introductory press conference to now, right? We're still within the time frame where he said he wanted to observe before making big decisions. And that to me is like the biggest story around this team. It's like, what can this team do? Can this team even change his mind about the right route forward to contending in this league now? Like, can they? I don't even know the answer to that, but I think it's a fascinating dynamic and a super unique one that really is sort of the biggest story we're going to be tracking here over the course of the next, you know, 2.5 months leading up to the March 21st deadline.
So you're saying, is he going to be a buyer or is he going to be a seller if they can still stay within striking distance by then?
Well, or some sort of hybrid seller, right? Like some sort of, trade some pieces, but also target win now pieces, right? That are cheaper. There's you know, the commentary he's been making about we need young players and draft picks suggests that there's, you know, very little interest on his end about being a buyer, right? He's certainly not talking like someone who's considering being a buyer. And that's sort of an interesting contrast with this, you know, team that's just a wave washing over the rest of the league right now.
Yeah, you know, you're right. And you know, and ultimately you might be able to justify not making the moves, because if this group is getting you to that point as constructed, you know, you may be in a position to have a different agenda at that point.
Well, and here's one to watch. Yaroslav Halak. You brought him up earlier, right? That they're going to need to find ways to get Demko rest and on, right? And that Yaroslav Halak has played really well for the Canucks, which is true. He's played exceptionally well. And he's the one to watch, Farhan, because he's played in 8 games, right? So in 2 games, if he appears in 2 more games, just 2, right? He'll earn a $1.25 million games played bonus, right? And because the Canucks are in LTI, that bonus will be applied as an overage against the Canucks salary cap next season. Not this season, next season, right? So in 2 games, 2 more games, the Canucks will have to eat that charge. If the Canucks are liberal in using Halak to spell Demko over the course of the next 2-3 weeks, I think that's a tell. I think that's a tell in a lot of ways that they firmly believe that this team can make the playoffs. If we see Halak held out in games we think he might otherwise start, and I'm not talking back-to-back, like there's a back-to-back, I think the 20, or is it the 15th of January? It's back-to-back coming up 15th, this month.
15th, 16th, Carolina and Washington, yeah. Back-to-back.
But that's, then, I think that's the only one this month.
So yeah, the next like, one is the 31st and 1st. 31st and 1st.
So he starts one of those games, but thereafter there's not like another mandatory backup start through the rest of the month. If that's the only game Halak plays in January, that to me is a tell that Rutherford is holding cards in reserve, right? That he is a little bit more muted on this team's playoff chances. Because if you can trade him before he hits those two games, and that won't be easy, right? He's got a no movement clause, right? Like he'd have to be in on it. You'd have to find a team that wants to eat that hit, that really needs a goalie, right? Like an Edmonton or something, right? Like a team that's really desperate for a puck stopper. You know, if you hold Halak in reserve through the month of January, right? If you really ride Demko, that to me is an indication. Like that to me means that the Canucks want to keep their options open and keep their cap flexibility open for next season in terms of how they navigate it. Like that to me, you know, this is a super niche, like hockey operations observation, but it's like, if you're a team, if you're a GM, if you're a new GM who's come into this situation and thinks this team needs more work, maybe may even need to take a step back to take a step forward in your second and third year, right? In the latter parts of your contract as the top executive running the team, being cautious about Halak starts over the next 4 to 6 weeks is like step one to preserving your cap flexibility to make changes this offseason and you know, sooner and beyond, in fact, right? So watch for that. I think that's going to be an early tell on what Rutherford is thinking.
Yeah, I think barring injury or some sort of Demko slump, I think that's the way they're going to go. I don't think you're going to see, I don't think you're going to see Halak play until one of those two games, Carolina, Washington.
Well, no, for sure. But I mean, thereafter, like the schedule's still dense in January, right? Like if that's all we see.
Yeah, they play every second day. They've got 2 days off between Nashville and Florida. And then after that, it's the home game against Florida, but then after that, it's every second day they play.
Right, and the Olympic break hits after February 1st. So it's like, if you start Halak in that game and no other game, right? If we don't see Halak play before February 1st, other than those that back-to-back set, right? Then Rutherford's bought himself an extra 6 weeks until February 24th. Although, you know, we'd assume that games will be scheduled between the 1st and the 24th, right? Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, you know, you've bought yourself some time. So for me, that's going to be an early tell. Like, well, and though I guess Blackhawks, Predators, 31st to the 1st is a back-to-back. So if we only see Halak play one game before February 1st, that will speak volumes. Like that will be a big italics tell about what Rutherford thinks and what his priorities are heading into the deadline, whether or not it's sort of maintaining or gaining some cap flexibility for next season and beyond, or whether it's, you know, riding with this team and seeing what they can do. Like that Halak bonus sort of stands as a key decision that will lock in something one way or another over the course of the next 3 weeks.
Few more minutes to go on this episode of the VanCast, the first for 2022. And look, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little bit about the story that really took not just the sports world, but like the world, and that is Brian Red Hamilton and his savior, Nadia Popovici from Seattle. You did a really, really nice piece in The Athletic on this,
thanks,
along with your colleague, Ryan Clark from Seattle. Just take me through it. What, you know, I think you brought up some different things in this piece than I think what the general story was, but just an amazing, amazing sequence of events.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a chance to chat with Red while they were loading the plane after the game. And Ryan had a chance to meet with Nadia after the game as well. So we were able to sort of talk about their meeting and try to bring people inside the actual meeting between them, which was kind of our goal from the outset, right? Like we wanted to capture the day in full. And so we were able to breathe on it a little bit. And I hope that gave people a different perspective or a different look into, you know, a really tremendous human story, like the 2022 story we all needed to start the year off, right? And I mean, first of all, and I know you agree with this, like Red is the best, right?
Absolutely.
Red is the absolute, absolute best guy. And I'm so grateful, just as someone who's often around this team, to hear that, you know, this was removed and that everything was negative and that he's well, and that this story had the outcome that it did. Like, I'm personally grateful that it played out this way. I wasn't aware of it, obviously, before the open letter. And, you know, I mean, I think the way that it played out with people sort of tracking the search and then tracking the meeting and then seeing her get a donation from both clubs toward her medical education. I mean, it was a pretty cool day. Like, it was one of the rare, fully positive, uplifting days on sports Twitter. But, you know, the thing that was really interesting to me, and so Ryan really talked to Nadia and her family, and I really sort of handled the Canucks side. And that's how we kind of broke it down. And, you know, there was a lot that was interesting to me. Like, one thing that Red told me after the game, and I don't know if this made the piece or not, I can't remember, but he said he was surprised when he met her that she thanked him, right? That they meet and he's like, thank you. And she's like, no, thank you. And he was stunned by that because he felt like he owed this person his life. And they were thanking him. And, you know, I think the reason for it is Nadia is a very young person. And no matter how dedicated you are or how disciplined you are in pursuit of whatever path you're on, right? And in her case, it's helping people and pursuing a medical education. You're always looking for signs like, is this what I should be doing? Is this my calling? Is this like the thing that I should be doing, right? Like, you're always... It's so common among young people, even truly remarkable young people who accelerated through high school and graduated university at 19, right? To sort of be wondering and just harboring some kind of doubt about your direction, your path. And for Nadia and her family, what happened on New Year's Day, out of the blue, they're caught up in a national or an international news story. You know, they took it as a sign. Right. Like, they took it as a sign that, you know, in fact, this is what you should be doing. You need to be helping people. You have something to provide that can change people's lives, that can impact people positively. And, you know, as I thought about that and as I just thought about, like, this was the right person, right? A person who's volunteered in an oncology clinic. She's family's Canucks and Kraken fans, you know. She happened to be in an area where you have a view of the trainers moving to and from the bench. Like, she wasn't sitting particularly close to the bench. She didn't see Red from the bench. She was positioned so that when they were setting up the benches, it's like a one-way mirror. They sort of noticed it as Red was setting things up and working pregame, right? Like, right person, right place, right time. And, you know, as a result, Red has this type 2 melanoma identified before it can penetrate the skin and gets a call from a doctor that both diagnoses and basically clears him of cancer in the same phone call. And that's like, honestly, I honestly get like choked up thinking about it, even just talking about it here. Like, you know, it's such a blessing for him. And honestly, it was a blessing for her too. And I think that's why this story resonates with people. Like, it's just incredible.
Yeah, it really is. And I mean, I've known Red since his days with the BC Lions, and he's been with the Canucks 20 years. So that's been a long time. And you're right. I mean, it's hard to find a more, you know, genuine, caring, unassuming person, right? And it is ironic that I can only imagine knowing him, his reaction at him being thanked, right? Because, you know, one of the things he did in that letter was not just find Nadia. It was to basically message to everybody that there is a way you can help, right? And I think that's so important, right? For people to get that message from it, right? That don't hold back. If you think you can help, if you think you can make a difference, do that, right? And I think that's what we all have to be thankful for in this entire story, right? Is that, yes, his life has completely taken a different turn, but it's the message to anybody else that you can help.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, you were at that Seattle game like I was, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there are hockey games and there are events. You know, that was an event.
No question.
Like, yeah. The Canucks were booed every time they stepped on the ice, right? It was like pantomime villain stuff, right? Like the Canucks enter stage left, like boo. For someone wearing a Kraken jersey with her experience to, with all the things you could be focused on that night, notice and alert the rival team's medical trainer to a worrisome mole on the back of their neck. I mean, it really does take someone with a special level of empathy to do that, right? And I think we're all grateful that that she did.
Absolutely. And pretty good note to wrap up our first episode of VanCast 2022. Promises to be a great year, Dredge. I promise this one's going to be better than the last. We hope, right? We hope.
But, yeah, low bar.
Yeah, the last 2 years have been a definite low bar, both from a hockey perspective and a global perspective, but we'll look forward to things getting better. Meanwhile, U.S. Olympian Gigi Marvin and Florida Panthers general manager Bill Zito are Craig Custance and Sean Gentile's guests this week on the Athletic Hockey Show USA. Also, guest host Julian McKenzie, along with Jesse Granger and Sarah Sivian, welcome Vince Trocheck back from the Carolina Hurricanes to the Athletic Hockey Show Roundtable. Mike Russo recaps the Winter Classic with his guests Kenny Albert, Darren Pang, Keith Jones, Jamie Hirsch, and Mike Rupp on this week's edition of
Trocheck, my guy.
I know. Did you watch the Winter Classic?
Well, he didn't play in the Winter Classic.
No, I know that. I know that. But we're just talking to
Mike. It looked cold.
Can't say I watched a minute of it, my friend. College bowl.
I mean,
game,
it looked
buddy.
Great, but it looked cold.
I know. I did see the highlights, and it did look unique, even by Winter Classic standards.
Yeah, and Trocheck, of course, is part of VanCast lore because Trocheck's favorite player in the league is Alexander Barkov, but his second favorite player, as told to me when the Canucks played the Panthers early in the 2019-20 season, Elias Pettersson.
Wow, we got through a whole VanCast without bringing him up. You spoiled it.
Wow, doesn't that speak volumes?
It does. But hey, we got a show on Wednesday. We will get to it then. Thank you for listening to the VanCast. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to leave a rating and a review. And right now, you can get annual subscriptions to The Athletic for just $3.99 a month when you visit theathletic.com/thevancast. Happy New Year, Dranser. We'll be back on Wednesday.
Happy New Year, Farhan, and Happy New Year, VIPs.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.